said to expect 16-foot waves. City Hall sat behind a 20-foot-high seawall that seemed more than enough to ensure their safety. Many citizens gathered outside to hear what was being decided. When a 45-foot tsunami came pouring over the seawall, they ran inside to try to get to the roof, but the only passage up was by a single ladder. A handful survived while hundreds of others were swept to their deaths, including the mayor and most of the city council. Of the 16,000 residents of Otsuchi, 1,300 lost their lives. Hiro and her brother were taken to an evacuation center, where she could only wait for someone from her family to come for her. Their home was near the ocean, and the waves had swept through her home and taken everything away. It was completely gone. 3 days after the tsunami, the road still closed, Takuya heard that some people were fleeing Otsuchi using an old mountain path. Following it in reverse, Takuya made it back to Otsuchi and found the evacuation center and his mother, who screamed and collapsed when she saw him. His father hadn't returned. The community struggled to come back from the brink of destruction in the weeks that followed. Emergency responders from the national government set up evacuation centers. Debris from the tsunami was collected. Bodies were sent to government-funded morgues and sorted by gender, age, and size. Takuya's close friend had lost his mother, and so each day, the two went together to all the morgues, Takuya looking at the male bodies and his friend at the female, each trying to find their parents' remains. Each day, along with hundreds of others, opening body bag after body bag, examining the dead, hoping against hope, searching for closure. A month after the tsunami, Takuya's father was finally found and brought to the morgue, where Takuya identified him. He had been found in his car, perhaps trying to evacuate or heading to the hospital to find his wife. After a month, in a mound of tsunami debris, he could be identified only by his distinctive watch. 400 of the dead in Otsuchi were never found. Similar devastation played out in town after town on the Tohoku coast. In Minami Sanriku, a young woman stayed at her post on the third floor of the emergency services building, broadcasting tsunami warnings, giving instructions. The tsunami ripped through the building and carried her to her death. In an elementary school in Ichinoseki, the teachers, untrained in how to respond to a tsunami warning, kept the children in their schoolyard. More than 2 miles from the ocean, they thought they were safe. The tsunami swept through despite the distance, killing 74 of the school's 102 students. In the end, 150 deaths were caused by the magnitude 9 earthquake, and more than 18,000 people were killed by the tsunami. Each of these deaths is a tragedy, and if this were the extent of the damage, it would be a significant, terrible disaster. Still, for an earthquake and tsunami of this unprecedented scale, Japan had weathered it as well as a country might reasonably hope to. The earthquake collapsed few buildings, and no trains were derailed. The tsunami, so much larger than expected, killed in terrible numbers, but its physical effects were endured by a relatively small part of Japan's population of more than 100 million, many fewer than the 140,000 who had died in Tokyo in 1923. What turned this event into a national catastrophe was not the earthquake alone, or even the pairing of earthquake and tsunami, but these two natural events in conjunction with one other significant man-made factor. Together, they created a crisis on a scale that Japan hadn't seen since World War II. Nuclear power plants harness the huge amount of heat generated by the splitting of the nuclei of large atoms, like those that make up uranium. This heat is used to create steam, which in turn is used to drive electric turbines and create the energy many of us consume in our daily lives. But the heat created in these nuclear reactions needs to be managed, to be drawn away from the nuclear fuel, or else we risk it melting, which will cause the vessel that contains the fuel to explode. So nuclear fuel is kept in circulating water to dissipate its heat. As a consequence, nuclear power plants are always built near major water sources, often the ocean, to facilitate cooling. Additionally, they have redundant backup power systems to make sure the heat management systems don't fail. In Japan, because of the ongoing risk of earthquakes and tsunamis, oceanside installations must consider the probable maximum tsunami they're likely to face. When the Fukushima Daiichi plant was built in the 1960s, the design basis tsunami height, which is the maximum height tsunami they might expect, was 10 feet. The plant was built 33 feet above sea level, which seemed a very comfortable margin of safety. And the engines for seawater pumps, the pumps that bring in water to cool nuclear fuel, were put at 13 feet above sea level. In 2002, the design height was revised to 20 feet, based on more detailed studies of past tsunamis. And the seawater pumps were sealed accordingly to protect them from inundation. In the years that followed, ancient records were studied that revealed an earthquake that had struck in AD 869 and that may have led to an even larger tsunami. In 2011, that risk was still being discussed. The appropriate action had not yet been agreed to. The Earthquake Research Committee was planning to release a report on it in April. The Fukushima Daiichi plant withstood the earthquake itself without significant damage. The nuclear reactors were automatically shut down as they were designed to do. But even once active reaction is stopped, there are residual processes that generate heat, and cooling remains essential. The earthquake caused a failure of the electric power grid that ran the cooling pumps, so backup generators kicked in. They seemed to be working as they should. The first surge of the tsunami hit Fukushima almost an hour after the earthquake, at 3:41 p.m., with a second, even larger surge 8 minutes later. The seawater pumps, whose engines had been sealed a decade prior, could withstand the waves, even at the massive scale they were experiencing. It was in the backup generators that the vulnerability lay. They were at too low a level and were completely inundated by the 40-foot-plus waves. As a consequence, the cooling systems failed for 3 of the 6 reactors on the site. Without effective cooling, the reactors overheated. Pressure built and nuclear fuel melted. It was only a matter of time before reactors began to explode. The earthquake and resulting tsunami occurred on a Friday afternoon. That evening, the Japanese government issued an emergency declaration evacuating people living within 2 miles of the plant. On Saturday, the evacuation zone was extended to 6 miles. Then an explosion caused by the melting fuel in Unit 1 blew the roof off the reactor building, releasing more radiation, and the evacuation zone was extended to 12 miles. On Sunday, a water injection system failed in another reactor, and the water level began falling dramatically as well. Although it wasn't clear at the time, damage to the nuclear core had begun early that morning, and much, if not all, of the fuel in at least one unit had melted. On Tuesday, another explosion led to an expansion of the evacuation zone to 20 miles. The plant had largely withstood the earthquake and even the tsunami, but those emergency generators were its Achilles heel. The insufficient cooling led to nuclear meltdowns, hydrogen air chemical explosions, and the release of radioactive material from three different reactors over the next 4 days. These incidents caused radioactive material to be released into the air and surrounding ocean. The chemicals emitted ionizing radiation, radiation with enough energy to change the atoms it comes into contact with. When that radiation hits human beings, it can alter our cells, leading to birth defects, cancers, and in the highest doses, radiation poisoning and death. Maki Sahara's home in the city of Fukushima was a bit more than 30 miles from the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. She and many of the almost 300,000 other residents of the city knew nothing about the problems at the power plant until 4 days after the tsunami. Without power, she had no television, and she and her neighbors were still busy dealing with the earthquake and its aftershocks. Her daughter's preschool graduation had been postponed as they waited for electricity to be restored. Residents were cleaning up the mess left behind by the earthquake. Food thrown out of cupboards onto the floor, broken dishes, glassware, and knickknacks. It all had to be dealt with. It was on Tuesday when evacuees from the coast started to arrive in Fukushima that Maki and her family discovered that this was more than just another large earthquake. These people, who had been forced out of their homes, some arriving with just the clothes on their backs, were measured for radiation exposure. Some of them carried such substantial radiation that even the clothes on their backs were taken from them. The government had first described the severity of the nuclear incident as a 4 on the international 0-7 scale. For reference, the Three Mile Island incident in the United States in 1979 had been a 5. The Chernobyl incident in the Soviet Union in 1986 was the only 7 to have ever occurred. The government warned that there was the possibility of more reactor explosions, but that the radioactivity released into the environment did not pose a risk to human health at that time. Maki noted the phrase, at that time, and wondered what was coming next. Over the next month, as the nuclear crisis unfolded, they discovered that the situation was much worse than they'd been told, especially for residents of Fukushima. The reactors and spent fuels continued to overheat, requiring them to be bathed in untreated seawater. Seawater is corrosive and leaks developed. Fires broke out, carrying more radiation into the environment. Storms and wind currents carried the radiation to the northwest, toward Fukushima. Radiation levels in the vicinity grew. After 2 weeks, even the tap water in Tokyo, over 150 miles south, showed twice the safe level for infants. By the end of March, radiation levels in the seawater immediately adjacent to the plant had levels of radiation that were 4,385 times what was considered safe. It was only with this absolute proof of the severity, a full month after the incident began, that the Japanese government revised the rating of the incident to a 7, on par with Chernobyl. As the circle of danger widened, many residents of smaller towns near the power plant moved to evacuation centers in Fukushima City. The city itself was a hotspot. It showed the highest levels of radiation outside the defined evacuation zone. But with 300,000 residents and now a wave of refugees, its evacuation would have been a Herculean task. The residents were told it was safe to stay. Elementary school students were not allowed to play outside, but as the city regrouped, middle schoolers and high schoolers continued with their outdoor athletics. But the radioactive materials were continuing to be released and dispersing into the environment. The heavier particles, like cesium and iodine, responsible for much of the radiation, settled into grassy areas and sandboxes. By the end of summer, the radiation levels in Fukushima City were so high that the government decided to remove the topsoil from every piece of exposed ground in the city. Schoolyards, parks, and backyards all had the top few inches of soil scraped up and put into large sealed plastic mounds. It took 5 years to complete the removal. The initial government assurances, followed by incidents that revealed those reassurances to be misplaced, sowed mistrust among the citizens. Maki Sahara was outraged at the lack of information and traveled to Tokyo to join protests. In those first few months after the tsunami, as many as 200,000 people took to the city's streets in demonstrations protesting the continued reliance on nuclear energy and the lack of communication about the situation in Fukushima. The anti-nuclear movement has a long history in Japan, the only country to have ever lost a city to an atomic bomb. The Fukushima Daiichi failure brought new focus to the movement, and activists came to Fukushima to help in the recovery. The Fukushima 30-year project was initiated to help residents get information about the radiation. With donations, the project bought scanners to assess food for safety, as well as full-body scanners to measure absorbed radiation. Classes and training were provided so residents could learn how to protect themselves and their families. The project pressured the government to install public radiation monitors in parks, which finally happened 2 years after the earthquake. Maki volunteered to help. She began as a receptionist, helping citizens access the services they needed. She didn't have training, but she wanted to make a difference. She scheduled the scans, signed people up for classes. If a scan showed a person had high levels, he would be offered counseling on ways to minimize exposure. The project offered classes that, for example, instructed parents to have their children play on concrete, not on grass or in sand. As time went on, Maki took on a larger and larger role. A local mother trying to protect her child was a much more effective voice for change than those of activists from Tokyo. She also knew her community and what the people needed. For instance, she was able to get handheld Geiger counters and created a training class to show children how to measure radiation, teaching them to recognize safe places to play. She empowered children to understand and take control, much as she had done. She found her purpose. Takuya Ueno, like most everyone else in Otsuchi, had lost almost everything of his former life. His childhood home, the home of generations of his family before him, was completely gone, swept away from its place near the ocean. The government decreed that the site was at too much risk from future tsunamis for rebuilding. His job had vanished, the factory had been destroyed. His father was gone too, and his mother consumed by grief. The national government came in with aid, but there was no local government to work with them. It took until August before the town was organized enough to elect a new mayor and city council to replace those who had died in the tsunami. How do you restart when nothing is left? Takuya began meeting with others who wanted to aid in the reconstruction. They brainstormed ways to create job opportunities. Outside rescue workers came to help. Among them was an emergency nurse, Mio Kamatani, who had worked at a hospital in Galveston, Texas in 2008 as Hurricane Ike put most of that city underwater. There, she had attended to patients too ill to be moved in the evacuation. Mio came to Otsuchi to provide psychological care, and she stayed to help the community rebuild. Takuya and Mio fell in love and married, living in the temporary housing units that were the town's only homes. One of the most difficult tasks facing Otsuchi was grappling with the emotional impact of the disaster. 400 of the lives lost there were lost completely, their bodies never recovered. The trauma of the event, coupled with the sheer magnitude of the death toll, made the transition through grief particularly difficult. When everyone is suffering from PTSD, who is left to help? Several years after the tsunami, the town organized a trip to the sacred mountain of Osorezan. A desolate volcanic landscape of sulfur-stained rock, the Osorezan site has, for more than a millennium, been venerated in the Buddhist tradition as a gateway to the afterlife. Many of the families who had lost husbands and wives, children and parents, went on this trip to pray for their dead and try to find closure. Takuya's mother, Hiro, went to pray for her husband and to let go of the grief. Otsuchi residents looking to find a way forward first self-organized, and their efforts led to the creation of a formal nonprofit called Oraga Otsuchi Yume Hiroba, which could be translated as a field of dreams for our Otsuchi. The goal of the organization is to inspire reconstruction, provide support to supplement government functions that have been degraded or lost, and revitalize local industries and tourism. They offer workshops to other communities on how organizations can work together to bring a community back from the brink, using their own hard-won examples. Takuya and Mio still ponder how an event could be so horrible, and yet could be the event that brought them together, that created for them a new life. Mio also derived from it a newfound sense of perspective. Asked what message she would share with others in the wake of the catastrophe she witnessed, she said, "Love, thank, and cherish your loved ones every day of your life." It sounds like a cliche, but that is what many cannot do anymore and miss the most. My town and other disaster areas are talked about in the sense of disaster prevention, preparedness, and reconstructions very frequently. But I think we can also be the ones to talk about love, because many of us have found our own definitions of what that is. She likewise urged others to believe that you have power and ability to make your own decisions, citing the dependence of many Japanese in 2011 on governments and agencies, groups that fell short in preserving their citizens' safety. I think it is very important for people to know that it is they who make decisions for their lives, not the warning systems. Megumi Ishimoto in Tokyo felt the effects of the nuclear meltdown more indirectly. All nuclear power plants were shut down, which meant that the entire country was running out of electricity. For many days, she went to work without power, without lights, without heat. She knew others were suffering more than she was, and she wanted to do something to help. But at that point, there were few organized volunteer efforts. She and her friends went to Ishinomeki, one of the towns heavily damaged by the tsunami, to remove debris. It was a turning point for Megumi. She came back to Tokyo, quit her job, and started looking for opportunities to do the humanitarian work that had been calling out to her even before the disaster. In early May, she went back to Tohoku, to another seaside town called Manami Sanriku. From across Japan, tens of thousands like her were going to Tohoku to volunteer their efforts, and several different groups had formed centers to coordinate with local and national governments. Most volunteers wanted to do the physical work of clearing debris because it let them connect with the local people. For her part, when Megumi arrived at the center in Manami Sanriku, she offered to do whatever was needed. With her executive management background, they asked her to take on the less glamorous back-office work, organizing teams and managing support for volunteers. She had originally intended to stay for a week, but the others begged her to stay longer. She agreed to stay for 1 to 3 months. The local government had requested that volunteers create a support group for the women in the evacuation center, and with her longer time commitment, Megumi was tasked with heading it up. Together with a city government official and a local woman, she visited evacuation centers. At first, much of their work was simply listening to what these women most needed. Many of the women they interviewed had been raised to remain quiet, to focus on their family's concerns and not their own. In situations where the conditions in the evacuation center were rough, exacerbating the trauma of being forced from their homes, these women didn't have a cultural framework that encouraged them to protest. And so Megumi's first job was to provide an environment where these traditional women could feel free to speak up. She created knitting groups, offering them a reason to show up. The first few were very quiet. After some time, women began to speak up. They told of the difficulties of being in such close quarters, and of the older men angry that the women's young children made so much noise. They talked about the male manager of supplies at the evacuation center, who handed out menstrual pads one at a time, and their embarrassment at having to discuss such a private matter with a strange man several times a day. And a few, very tentatively, began to talk of the sexual aggression they faced in the centers. Through these conversations, Megumi came to realize that if her organization was going to help the disaster's most vulnerable, the babies and the elderly, they needed to ensure that the women were cared for, since they were the predominant caregivers. She also realized that as families were moved from evacuation centers to temporary housing, the city program, based in evacuation centers, was losing contact with them at a time when they still needed support. Recognizing the gap, she decided to form a separate, farther-reaching women's resource center. It began with no money, but Megumi was able to secure funding from foundations and gradually from government programs as well. It began as a place of support for women in temporary housing and otherwise affected by the tsunami, to talk, to assist in the struggle with bureaucracy. Her organization has evolved over 5 years into Women's Eye, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting the women in Tohoku as they work to rebuild their homes and communities. The members are women entrepreneurs, creating businesses and nonprofits to revitalize Tohoku. Maki Sahara and Mio Kamatani are both members, as are a midwife starting a chain of modern birth clinics, a photographer, and the owner of a seaweed processing plant. Women's Eye connects them with one another to help them see they aren't alone, and it provides business and leadership training. It also allied itself with a larger national movement, the Japan Women's Network for Disaster Risk Reduction. Akiko Domoto was the first woman governor of Chiba Province. As president of the organization, she tackles real problems in disaster response as it affects women, but also the underlying issues of gender inequality that the disaster exposes. For Jackie Steele, the Canadian researcher in Sendai with a 6-month-old baby, the earthquake meant having to leave her home. Without heat and water, she didn't know how else to keep her baby safe. Unlike Maki, she heard about the nuclear problems as they unfolded, and she knew that her home was downwind from the plant, and babies were the most at risk. Her parents and friends begged her to come back to Canada, but that would feel like abandoning her community in Sendai and the 2 years of postdoctoral research in political science that were nearly complete. Still, after 2 very cold nights, she had no choice but to go somewhere. She had a half tank of gas, luckily, so she was able to drive away. She stayed with friends in Nagano, safely removed from the crisis. Jackie ultimately left Sendai, but not Japan. Before March 11th, Jackie's research had been on diversity and women's political citizenship. With her experience of the earthquake and her observations of response and recovery, she became interested in the governance of natural disasters, how governments function in times of crisis. She was especially concerned with how women were treated in this process, which is how she became connected to Governor Domoto's organization, as well as to Megumi and Women's Eye. Jackie is now an associate professor of political science at the University of Tokyo, and she comes back to the Tohoku region to study how residents are creating something new in Japan. They are learning that these women are more than just mothers, doing what they must to support their families. They are critical pieces of their communities, bringing it back to life and creating a new, more inclusive future for women. In the spring of 2017, I spent a day with Maki Sahara, learning about her efforts to bring radiation data, awareness, and training to Fukushima. She had by then taken over operation of the Fukushima 30-year project, a long way removed from her life as a housewife 6 years prior. She has the determination to keep the project going, to maintain focus. She knows one of the most difficult parts of recovery is the failure of our attention spans. The world inevitably moves on to other disasters, other crises, other needs. But for the people of Tohoku, the recovery was ongoing. Years later, many still lived in temporary housing. The area immediately around the Daiichi plant was still uninhabitable. The town of Otsuchi was still trying to decide whether their devastated city hall should be kept as a memorial or torn down so the community could move on. Recovery can be an agonizingly long process. At the end of our day together, I asked Maki if there was one thing she could share with the world, what it would be. She told me she wanted to be able, in 20 years' time, to look back and be relieved that she and her fellow organizers did more than what was required to keep children safe. Because it would be too awful to contemplate looking back and seeing that they had done too little. Chapter 12, Resilience by Design. Los Angeles, California, sometime in the future. With each passing year, the enviable physical, economic, and social circumstances of the United States are more vulnerable to natural and technological hazards. The United States has been, and still is, creating for itself increasingly catastrophic future disasters. Dennis Mileti, Disasters by Design. Los Angeles owes its existence to earthquakes. Its location in the arid Southwest could have left it an uninhabitable desert had it not been for the mountains that surround it, pushed up by active faults, capturing moisture from the clouds that come off the ocean. Those same faults trap groundwater, creating the springs that were used by the original settlers to irrigate their crops. The modern city began to flourish at the beginning of the 20th century with the discovery of oil. Oil that was likewise collected by faults, with the biggest deposits near the Newport-Inglewood Fault, which runs through Long Beach and Los Angeles's west side. Faults may have made Los Angeles a viable city, but they are a precarious asset, and the risk of earthquakes is ever present. The Newport-Inglewood Fault was responsible for a magnitude 6.3 earthquake in 1933, destroying more than 700 schools and shaking out with it America's first piece of earthquake safety legislation. The Field Act mandated higher building standards for public schools, the first seismic building codes. When the 1971 San Fernando earthquake destroyed not just decades-old structures, but modern engineered buildings, most significantly the new psychiatric ward at the Olive View Hospital, it led to a wholesale revision in the building code. When the 1994 Northridge earthquake struck, bringing down two freeway bridges, it convinced us that our freeways could not be trusted and triggered $10 billion in retrofits by the California Department of Transportation. These three earthquakes, 1933, 1971, and 1994, have evoked in us contradictory beliefs. On one hand, they inspired us to ready ourselves, to ensure that we're suitably prepared to withstand and respond. But just as important, they have fooled us into thinking that we know how to handle earthquakes. After all, the city responded and thrived each time. In 1933, with 700 schools destroyed, students went to school in tents for 2 years. But all the schools were eventually rebuilt in a new, stronger style. In 1971, 110 fires were triggered and successfully fought. A dam almost failed, which would have inundated 80,000 residents. But everyone was evacuated and the water level was drawn down in time so that no flood ensued. In 1994, the whole city lost electric power and got it back in 24 hours. Each event triggered further safety legislation with ever stricter codes for schools, hospitals, and freeways. Each made us think that earthquakes were manageable, that the risk to Los Angeles was not so great. But there are two dangerous flaws to this way of thinking. The first is that the resulting programs have always been designed to satisfy the public's outrage, keeping in mind the desire not to spend too much of the city's money. For each piece of legislation enacted, there are countless others that were proposed and that were just as worthy, but that couldn't muster the support to justify their price tag. The easiest programs to initiate tended to support response rather than prevention. The public can embrace the idea of a fire department that is sufficiently outfitted, but demanding that building owners repair their unreliable structures is a more difficult proposition. After all, they have to live with the consequences of their decisions. Shouldn't they be entitled to make their own choices, no matter how reckless? This points us to the second major flaw in this perception of safety. Namely, of course, that these earthquakes, 1933, 1971, and 1994, just weren't that big. They certainly seemed like it when you consider the cost, $50 million, $500 million, and $40 billion, and the lives lost, 115, 64, and 57. But their magnitudes, 6.3, 6.6, and 6.7, reflect the relatively short faults that broke in each, none more than a dozen miles in length. Nowhere near the San Andreas quake my colleagues and I modeled. They weren't the big one. When big ones strike, our individual choices won't exist in isolation. The fires that swept through Tokyo weren't confined to the properties where they started. The water pouring out of a levee crevasse doesn't recognize county borders. Big ones have the power not just to impact communities, but to utterly transform them. They can destroy industries, as the California floods of the 1860s did. They can create a nation of refugees, like Iceland after Laki. They can set back economies for decades or more, as with 18th century Portugal. They can make or break political fortunes. Preparing for the big one is categorically different from preparing for the sort of big ones. Eric Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles since 2013, is the quintessential Angeleno. In a city of immigrants, he is his own melting pot. His Italian forebears settled in Mexico. His paternal grandfather was brought to California as an infant after his father was murdered in the Mexican Revolution. His mother was a Russian emigre, making him both the first Jewish and the second Latino mayor of Los Angeles. He often relates that he was born in the San Fernando Valley near the fault that produced the 1971 San Fernando earthquake just 5 days before it struck. He tells that story to suggest that he was perhaps destined to deal with earthquakes. At the urging of a friend and colleague who knew Garcetti, I met the mayor a few months after he took office. I wasn't sure it would be worth the time, frankly. I had led the creation of the shakeout scenario 6 years earlier, thinking that if we put our scientific understanding into concrete terms, people would recognize that outcomes were under their control and thus feel compelled to act on them. The scenario was popular, widely read, and used by many agencies to plan their response to a big earthquake. But it wasn't being used for prevention the way I thought it should. People didn't seem to be able to make the leap from understanding the potential for damage to believing their actions could actually prevent it. There was a ray of hope, though, a program slowly getting underway in San Francisco. A 10-year push by engineers and scientists in the area had finally led to the creation of the Community Action Plan for Seismic Safety, a blueprint for measures that could be taken by the city to reduce its risk in the event of an earthquake. So, with their initiative in mind, I requested a meeting with Mayor Garcetti to tell him about the San Francisco project and maybe get a little city rivalry going. The mayor later told me that my visit was both exhilarating and terrifying. He was still new at the job. He told me that he had imagined that moving from his 6 years as city council president to mayor would be like trading up from a Toyota Corolla to a Camry, a similar job with better tools. The reality, he said, was more like going from a Corolla to a semi-trailer truck. He was still trying to comprehend all his responsibilities. Then I arrived, attempting to convey with certainty and clarity what lay ahead, albeit at an unknown time in our future. It was, understandably, a lot to digest. It was as though I pulled him out of the truck and plopped him down in front of the controls of an airplane. The most fundamental function of government is to provide for public safety. During that meeting, I told him that it might be unattainable. But he didn't shut down the meeting. We kept on talking. I found in Mayor Garcetti an elected official who thought more like a scientist than I had expected. He was committed to data, to evaluating what was being done in quantifiable terms. One of his big initiatives as mayor has been to open up the city's data, recognizing that sharing it was the only reliable path to improvement. Embracing the shame if need be, he added. We found that we understood each other. Two born and bred Angelenos who wanted the same thing, to see our city endure. So we tried something that hadn't been done before. We negotiated an agreement between the U.S. Geological Survey, my federal agency, and the City of Los Angeles, in which I would spend a year at City Hall, working with the mayor's staff to come up with solutions to the city's most pressing seismic problems. We made a big public statement that we were collaborating to find solutions we couldn't have arrived at on our own. What followed was a dissolving of boundaries. For me, it was a year-long experiment in understanding not just what data was most relevant to the city in the event of the big one, but also what information best connected with citizens, inspired them to act. For policymakers, it was an experiment in diving into the technical. Engineers came to City Hall. City Hall visited the Water Department. I received my first lesson in the political realities of disaster prevention early on. In fact, before I even started. The agreement between the USGS and the city that provided for my transfer required framing the problems we set out to solve in the year ahead. It did not call for a comprehensive seismic safety plan the way I might have imagined, but instead for addressing three specific issues: strengthening older buildings that we knew to be vulnerable, safeguarding the city's water system, and reinforcing our telecommunication systems. These were, without question, big and important problems to address. But they were far from the only ones. It was then that I realized how important it was not just to advance the cause more broadly, but to do so in a way that allowed us to demonstrate concrete, measurable levels of success. Only by being seen as successful would we gain the political support to see the project through. Our message needed to register on the right emotional level, too. Shakeout was the synthesis of decades of research, but to inspire action, it needed to be a story, something that translated the science of the San Andreas earthquake into a tangible reality. When our research was published in 2008, we had created a short movie as a sort of synopsis, as well as a written narrative version of it, more accessible to the public, we hoped, than a scientific paper. The story we composed began 10 minutes before the earthquake and ended 6 months after. To accomplish the mayor's goals, I relied heavily on both versions. We decided to reach out to the unwitting actors in our story, those who stood to lose so much. I convened and presided over 130 public meetings in 10 months. Meetings with building officials and building owners, with structural engineers and civil engineers, with apartment owners and tenants, with urban planners and urban developers. In addition to conveying the story of the earthquake that we had put together, I listened for reactions, ideas, solutions. Many details of the final proposal came from citizens who attended these meetings and would be affected by our plan. In addition to contributing valuable ideas, they were given a stake in its success. I learned, too, to avoid all discussion of probabilities. The question of when a disaster will strike is perhaps inevitable, but it triggers our fear, compelling us to hide from the problem. When is a probabilistic uncertainty? As a scientist, I know that uncertainties matter. To convince my colleagues of a result, I need to demonstrate that I have analyzed them and taken them into account. But policymakers need to focus on the what, not the when. Their policies can't affect when a disaster strikes, but they can absolutely change its impact. I emphasized that the big one was likely enough, that it would occur soon enough to be worth our preparing for. I made a point to emphasize financial consequences, not the threat to lives. Again, we were trying to steer people away from fear, reminding them that they would have to pay for the earthquake at one time or another, before or after, so why not avoid the damage altogether? We also focused on how our vulnerability is shared, that someone's decision not to be ready increases the chances that others in the area will suffer. Our message got through. The mayor released our plan, called Resilience by Design, at the end of 2014. The culmination of my year at City Hall, it included 18 recommendations issued to address our three identified priorities, written with 20 members of the mayor's staff. It didn't solve everything, but it was easily the biggest step ever taken in California toward seismic safety. It was the mayor's plan. He was the final arbiter of what was included. And even as we worked in close collaboration, I came to realize how important it is to maintain a distinction between science and policy. If scientists start making policy, we invite politicians to start making science. By instead empowering politicians with the information to make informed decisions, we create more forceful advocates for the results of our collaboration. Some aspects of the plan were completely up to the mayor to enact. The city instituted a wide-ranging approach to protecting the municipal water system. New projects would be reviewed for their seismic resilience. Engineering plans were undertaken to protect the aqueduct that brings water from the Sierra Nevada mountains and crosses the San Andreas Fault in an old wooden tunnel built in 1908. The city committed to using seismic-resistant pipes to deliver water to houses and businesses. 5 such pilot projects are now installed. The water department is working with the fire department to create redundant, resilient sources of emergency firefighting water. A plan for citywide solar-powered Wi-Fi as a fallback for when cell towers run out of their 4-hour backup power, is moving forward. Many of the proposals required action by the City Council. Several ordinances were proposed to retrofit two types of unreliable building, create a loan program for the retrofits, and require future cell phone towers to be built to a more resilient standard. Negotiations went on for almost a year, but in October 2015, the ordinances were passed by a unanimous vote of the City Council. Many of the organizations representing the building owners, which might have otherwise presented significant opposition, had instead been part of the development process. They stood with the mayor as he announced the result. Even though building owners would have to pay the full cost, we had convinced them they had more to lose by not retrofitting. Perhaps more significantly, they had come to understand how much they stood to lose if their neighbor didn't do so. The fact that everyone had to do their part and that the city would be paying for the improvements to the water system as well as the retrofits of their own buildings made the sacrifice a shared one. Almost 20,000 buildings will be retrofitted over the next 7 to 25 years. When our big one comes, lives will be saved for what we collectively accomplished, a fact that never fails to amaze me. Scientific researchers rarely see such concrete results of their work. To my surprise, the mayor saw it the same way. "It is, to date, one of the best experiences of my life as a policymaker," he told me. "We did something incredibly complex, not easy financially, and we did it really with no opposition at the end. And in government terms, we did it very quickly." The Los Angeles Downtown News, a regional weekly paper, remarked in an editorial on the political challenges of a plan like ours. "If the big one strikes in the next few years, then there will probably not have been enough time to effect the most significant changes Garcetti wants. If a massive tumbler hits after he leaves office, and the city turns out to be well prepared, then he may not be around to take the credit." All of which indicates that Garcetti may be focusing on earthquake safety because it's, gasp, the right thing to do for the city. They're right on all counts. But in the funny, unpredictable way of politics, Mayor Garcetti has reaped benefits from the program after all. All the news outlets praised the program. And while this was obviously not the only activity the mayor undertook in his first term of office, he did win re-election to a second term with 81% of the vote. Other elected officials have noticed. The Southern California Association of Governments is supporting further seismic programs among its 191 other constituent cities. In the 2 years since Los Angeles passed its mandatory retrofit ordinances, two more cities, Santa Monica and West Hollywood, have followed suit and passed similar laws. When the Puebla earthquake of 2017 brought down many similar buildings in Mexico City, the Los Angeles Times reminded its readers of the courageous actions of Mayor Garcetti and encouraged even more cities to join. More than 36 in Southern California now have programs in the works. These Southern California initiatives, alongside the move to hire chief resilience officers in many cities around the country, many of them supported by the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities program, and the UN's initiative for global disaster risk reduction, all point toward a broader awareness of disaster. We've seen it across the world in the last decade. It is a movement in which our scientific understanding, especially our ability to comprehend time spans longer than that of human memory, is allowing us to overcome our ingrained biases. As civilizations, we have, across our history, come to disasters